Welcome to Native America Calling. From Studio 49 in Albuquerque, I'm Tara Gatewood. Turquoise squash blossoms, inlay coral bracelets, ivory necklaces, and sealskin earrings are all beautiful creations from the Native art world. Shortages and heavy regulations on some of the choice materials have artists altering their work and raising their prices. In the next hour, we'll hear about how these shortages are impacting Native art and the artists who make a living through their craft. If you're one of them, we'll want to hear from you too. That's what's next, right after National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. This week on our program, we've been reporting on rural sanitation in Alaska. Remote Alaska communities often have a hard time getting funding to build modern sanitation systems. Those that have face the threat of the system's failure due to the lack of cash for operations and maintenance, which can wipe away any gains that were achieved. Here's the third segment in the series by KMBA's Jocelyn Estes.
The Yukon-Kuskokwim Health Corporation Environmental Health and Engineering Department, based in Bethel, provides technical assistance to water treatment plant operators in the region, often meeting by teleconference.
I don't know if any of them are working.
Yeah, it's just a temperature sensor on the pump.
One of the issues that comes up is the lack of funding for minor repairs.
You know, if we could spend $1,000 to save 24, it'd be great.
Big savings could be achieved by cutting energy use, which makes up 40% of operating costs. At the new Gwethlook water plant, YKHC remote maintenance worker Bob White says new boilers used to heat water there use about half as much fuel as older ones, but he says they're out of reach for many villages.
And sometimes they just don't have the cash to make the jump to buy into the new equipment, to buy the new controls. This thing has a little computerized control that automatically has turned the boiler temperature down because it's warmer out today.
Back in 1995, the Southwest Alaska village of Tuntutuliak got a new water and sewer system, too. Villagers saw dozens of homes fitted with tanks to store water and waste. Workers could deliver water and pick up sewage in tanks hauled by snow machines or all-terrain vehicles. But resident Robert Enoch says water delivery stopped a few years ago.
The water delivery vehicles, the haul tanks, don't work anymore.
That leaves villagers hauling water or ice for household use and cutting back to use less water than needed for frequent hand washing to prevent the spread of viruses and bacteria. To save on expenses, the village hired only part-time workers and charged people about 5% of the median household income. Most Americans pay about 1% for water and sewer services. But without the economies of scale that come with larger populations, the village couldn't replace equipment. Gavin Dixon is Rural Energy Project Manager for the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium. Speaking to legislators from rural Alaska, he said maintenance costs are also high because the average rural water plant is operating past its expected design life of 20 to 30 years.
A lot of these systems are already at the end of their useful life. There are some of these plants, the operator don't even want to open or close valves because they're afraid that that would result in a catastrophic issue there.
Yukon-Kuskokwim Health Corporation Environmental Health and Engineering Director Brian Lefferts says the state government already supports utilities such as infrastructure, communications, and energy. He says it would make a big difference if it also subsidized water and sewer.
If people could pay rates similar to what they pay on the road system or on the rail belt communities, we'd have a lot more systems that are online and not struggling with the problems that they have now.
But the state is headed in the opposite direction. State government in Alaska is 92% funded by oil revenues. And because the price of oil is half what it was a year ago, the state is facing a $3 billion deficit and cutting budgets. There's got to be a better way. We'll hear about some proposed alternatives next time. Reporting in Anchorage, I'm Jocelyn Estes.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation. And by the law firm of Sanosky, Chambers, Saxe, Miller & Munson, advocating Native American interests throughout the United States, with offices in New Mexico, California, Alaska, and Washington, D.C.
Support by United Tribes Technical College, offering courses online for a career in medical coding and for updating your current coding certification. Registration available through August 10th online at uttc.edu.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
This is Native America Calling. I'm Tara Gatewood. Jewelry is a big part of Native art and culture, and Native artists have been using vibrant materials to string on necklaces and embed in silver. And the availability of some materials, like turquoise, are shrinking as mines run dry and cheaper alternatives flood the marketplace. Ivory and certain furs are also becoming harder to come by. And the shortages of these materials have some Native artists changing the way they make their craft. And they are also raising their prices. So when prices rise or regulations get tighter on unique materials, what is the fallout for Native artists who are making a living off of their artistry? And does this make more room for fraud? And how do you know whether your necklace is real turquoise or American turquoise? And for those of you who purchase Native American artwork like jewelry or other wearable items, what's your take on things? Are the shortages and price hikes changing the way you collect or wear jewelry? Call us and join our conversation. Our number is 1-800-996-2848. That's also 1-800-99-NATIVE. And Native artists, if you're out there, we want to hear from you today. Give us a call. Phone lines are open. Don't be shy. If you want to call in anonymously, you can too. Again, our number, 1-800-996-2848. And now joining us from Albuquerque, New Mexico, is Jacob Morgan. He is a sixth-generation Navajo silversmith, and it's our pleasure to welcome him to the hour. Good day to you, Jacob.
Good morning, Tara. Thank you for having me.
And Jacob, thanks for being with us. You know, as we talk about the changing scene for Native artists, especially often Native jewelers, and in your case, silversmiths, tell us a little bit about, you know, this shortage of materials. Do you feel that there is a true shortage?
Not in my generation. I highly doubt that. I do feel the impact. It is harder to come by high-grade turquoise. Silver, as an example, you know, we had the spike in prices, and people attributed it to so many things as far as the price was concerned. And they also said that there was a shortage of silver ore. Now, whether or not that's true, I can't speak to it, but as far as me going to a supply store or a turquoise vendor to buy these materials, the prices do affect how I go about as far as how many pieces I need to make and what type of price ranges I'm looking at. And it really does affect my budget. So I've got to be really conscious on the market value of silver and the particular mines that I'm going after, because I really like to use Morenci turquoise. I like to use Bisbee turquoise, mainly the classic Southwest mines that people can look at and not have a second thought as to whether or not it is a true Royston, a number 8, or a Candelaria stone.
Sure, and all of those stones you just mentioned are so beautiful. Jacob, you know, what about just being an artist? Do you ever feel limited that, you know, you just can't go somewhere and choose different stones or the color that you're wanting? You have to kind of tailor things by price.
Well, my personal experience is that I have a love-hate relationship with turquoise. Back in 2011, I went to see one of my friends, a very fine gentleman by the name of Ernie Montoya, and he's taught me a lot about the turquoise business, what to look for, how to select grades. And I spent about $2,000 in turquoise gearing up for the Herd Museum show that year and also for Santa Fe Indian Market. Now, those particular shows, I had mediocre to poor sales. And so the amount of money that I spent on turquoise really affected me. And I had put that on a business credit card. And so not being able to recoup the costs in addition with the travel expenses, hotel expenses, and just materials in general, that really affected me and took me quite a while to get out of that. So I had the mind frame that I would limit the amount of turquoise that I used and concentrate mainly on designs and focus more on how to shape silver, how to do different designs instead of constantly having to rely on turquoise. So that was a really good learning experience, and I'm glad that happened because it actually turns out it actually translates to what we're discussing now. You know, we're not able to go to the supply store or call the vendor and get the kind of turquoise that we want. And if we do, we have to pay a lot more out of our pocket to get that turquoise. So I do highly encourage silversmiths to, if they're trying now to find out how to make pieces without turquoise, you know, try 20% of your inventory, little by little, just kind of throttle it back. Me personally, I usually use one stone in all my pieces, and again, it's just for cost effectiveness.
All right. And Jacob, you know, I know there's a lot of Native artists that can relate to this too. And if you're out there, come on, call us right now, 1-800-996-2848. That's also 1-800-99-NATIVE. And has, you know, the supply on certain materials. Jacob is telling us a little bit about turquoise, but what about things like coral or ivory or maybe even lapis or some of those other items that you like to put into your work? Has a short supply changed the way you create? Call us right now. We want to hear from you. Maybe you've even embraced this, much like Jacob, and you've turned to putting more metal in your work. What do you think about that transition? Has it been good? And also, what about the audiences, the people who come and buy jewelry? Are they surprised to not see as much turquoise anymore? Do you have to explain things? Call us right now. Phone lines are open. 1-800-996-2848. Is the number to join us. And Jacob, I know there's a great camaraderie among Native artists, especially jewelers. What kind of conversation is going on with your peers? You know, do people feel similar or have you heard other views on this?
Certainly. There's quite a few jewelers at the moment that are doing amazing things with other metals, stainless, titanium. And they're making pieces. Take, for instance, Cody Sanderson, a guy I highly admire. He's doing magnificent work with silver alone, incorporating new technology. There's other people that stray from turquoise, and they're going utilizing agate stones. They're utilizing different stones. Sometimes you'll see ivory, like you had mentioned at the beginning of the show. Just trying to get a feel for, I guess, what's inevitably going to come, and you know that is a really good crisis, or I'm sorry, an unfortunate crisis in the turquoise supply.
Yeah, and you know we're also hearing similar things too when it comes to coral. I know a lot of folks also incorporate that into the mix too. And you know, if you're one of the peers too, want to comment on this, we do want to hear from you. Give us a call, 1-800-996-2848. And Jacob, what about, you know, the people who are purchasing these items? You know, do Native artists ever have to explain why their prices are so high? And do people accept that story?
From my experience, at the beginning, in all honesty, my dad never really had to go out and purchase turquoise. It was always brought to him, supplied to him, and he made pieces out of it. But when I started in 2006, I had a tremendous amount of help from Lyndon Soucy and Daryl Begay. They showed me the importance of turquoise, the value of turquoise and what it means to actually use good stones in your work, because a good stone complements your piece. At the beginning, it is kind of tough. There's a formula or a theory, I like to call it, as far as pricing your work. You typically take all your material, your cost, your overhead, and your time. You multiply that by 3, and that would be your retail price. Slash that in half to 50%, and that's your wholesale price. Now, that's not always going to happen. That's why I call it a theory. For everybody, it's going to be different. For people that are just starting out, you might, like, say, for instance, you buy a piece of turquoise that's selling for $10 a carat that you actually have to buy. And if you have a 20-carat stone, obviously you can't triple that price. So early on, you're probably going to have to put a 10% markup just on the stone alone and go about however you price your silver, gold, whatever it may be. But there is, like, for me, for instance, what I'll do is the more established that you get, the little easier it is to start marking up that turquoise. But for me, I just, right about now, I'm still putting possibly like a 30% markup on turquoise. I can't get to that point. So it always depends on the stage of the artist, what level they're at.
All right. Thanks for that, Jacob. And, you know, I've heard from Native artists, too, you know, similar things about, you know, how they price. And often, you know, when they do have this conversation of why a certain item has a certain price to it, a lot of times people don't understand. And, you know, that costs the artists times, you know, with the pieces that they're making. And but I want to hear it straight from the artist, too. Come on, guys, give us a call. Phone lines are open, 1-800-996-2848. Don't let me tell your story. You tell it. Call us right now, 1-800-99-NATIVE. Let's take our first caller. We have Veronica in Zuni, New Mexico, tuned in on KSHI. Welcome to the hour, Veronica.
Thank you very much for having me.
And Veronica, thank you for being with us. What do you think about all of this?
Well, being an established artist here in our community, I have reached far and beyond to look for precious gemstones such as turquoise. The highly graded turquoise is my thing. I use all kinds of mines from Bisbee, Newlander, Carrico Lake, Lander turquoise, and just to name a few, and especially this beautiful lime green turquoise called Orville Jack. Orville Jack is a beautiful stone that I had acquired back in the early 90s. I used to do the show. I mean, I still do shows in Santa Fe and all these museum shows throughout, and it's I guess, about how established you are to know what you're working with and the value of what you're working with, such as different types of turquoise. I know the Sleeping Beauty mine is non-existent right now because of the Chinese people taking over that turquoise, and it's been sold. And I know the local artisans here in Zuni are much more familiar with this type of turquoise in their inlay work. And for me, especially as a traveling artist, I look for the exotic color and the textures and the, you know, just the beauty of different kinds of turquoise. You know, I'm not limited to one stone, of one variety, I mean, but just to expand my horizons and use all kinds of different types of turquoise that enhances the work.
And Veronica, let me ask you this, you know, just kind of going with what's available or sometimes going with what you can afford. Do you welcome this in any way? Has it, you know, made you be more creative?
You mean with the turquoise that I use?
Sure.
Yeah, I'm very innovative in what I do. Everything that I do is all one of a kind. And there's so many things that you can do just to accentuate if you cannot afford to use a certain type of turquoise that is out there in the market that is, you know, maybe so expensive that you can't afford it, you can just accentuate a piece with your modern designs. That's what I do. My work is very modern and all one of a kind, like I said. And, you know, it's the Sleeping Beauty mine is just, you know, fading out in the U.S. because the Chinese have bought all the mines from Arizona. But there's still good variety of all sorts of turquoise if you know what you're looking for.
So you kind of got an eye for it too. Well, Veronica, we do appreciate you giving us a call. And I know there are many artists there in the Zuni area who can also comment on this. And we want to hear from you. You know, we're not coming away with a verdict today of, you know, the turquoise supply, but we do want to hear, you know, how this affects you, especially the way people buy jewelry. Give us a call. Phone lines are open. The number is 1-800-996-2848. We want to learn more about the supply and demand aspect of this. So we invited a gentleman joining us today from Scottsdale, Arizona. On the line, we have Gene Waddell. He is the owner of Waddell Trading Company and also the co-owner of the Lone Mountain Turquoise Mine. And we'd like to welcome him to the hour. Hello, Gene.
Hello, Tara. Again, thanks for inviting me this morning to be part of this panel discussion. And Jacob really contributed some great things and brought some valuable questions and answers to this discussion. And thanks, Jacob. But I'll give you a little bit of my background. We started my family in the business in Gallup in 1939. We had a small trading post. It wasn't like one of the big ones. But eventually we moved to Arizona. My father got involved in turquoise mining. In 1955, he bought in and became a partner in the Fox Turquoise Mine in Nevada. And then eventually he became a partner in the Evans Mine in Mexico. And then later on in 1979, I went in with a group and we bought the Lone Mountain Turquoise Mine, which really sounds impressive, except the fact is that it's very expensive to mine. Generally, miners in Nevada especially have just gotten by. They mine turquoise in the old days. They take it down to Gallup in Albuquerque, sell to the dealers. They would get X amount of money for their product, about enough to go back and mine again. And in more recent times, as Veronica was saying, some of the mines in this country, especially Sleeping Beauty, what's happened with Sleeping Beauty, it was closed because it has an overhang problem that they've mined themselves into a problem. And it would cost, according to estimates, $5 million to reopen that mine. So it's just sitting there. The Chinese don't own it, but what they're doing is coming over. Many dealers from China now are buying up southwestern American turquoise. And that's an issue a lot of people aren't aware of. They've become another competitor to buy a turquoise. Actually, they've come up to our mine at Lone Mountain to buy turquoise, and we're mining very little right now, so we don't have much to sell, but they're buying Royston, they're up at Kingman every day. There's maybe three buyers from China. So I think that adds another dimension that we're not feeling yet. The artists aren't feeling, the retail establishments aren't feeling, the collectors aren't feeling. I think we're all going to feel that in the next year or so. That what I saw a week ago, I went to the gym show up in Las Vegas, and there were over 200 dealers just from China, and there was probably 1,000 dealers altogether around the world. They were selling everything from diamonds to watches to finished product, but there were quite a few dealers in coral and turquoise, and the price of coral and turquoise was incredible, numbers that I never would have thought that it would have reached. And I think they're going to price themselves out of the native market and out of the market I'm in, which is selling quality, the finest quality and Native American jewelry.
And Gene, I know a lot of people, turn to Lone Mountain Turquoise in their work too. And thank you for elaborating more on, you know, kind of the world market. Gene, do you know why there is an interest coming, you know, out of Asia for some of these stones? Is it, you know, is there a huge turquoise jewelry market going on there, or is it being used for something else? Can you expand on that part?
Yeah, and these are things I've been fortunate to learn really over just the last month or two. And it's just we met with some Chinese buyers that actually, the one fellow's an electrical engineer. They speak very good English, so it was easy to understand what was going on. And the fact is, and I think Jacob and Veronica and the other native artists listening saw the time whenever all the Chinese turquoise was coming in, and it was pretty readily available, and it was fairly reasonable in price. Of course, many of the collectors and many of people who buy this, not everybody's a collector, but I mean people who loved what Native Americans make, and that's, and I include myself amongst that group, that the problem became that other countries became involved aside from this. And the Chinese are buying it right now. They love beads, and so they're making beads. They're going to buy anything that's big enough to make an 8-millimeter bead or bigger. So Sleeping Beauty was perfect. It was clear. It was, you know, it could make larger beads, up to 16-millimeter beads. So they weren't making it into cabochons. They weren't making it into Native American jewelry. They weren't copying the Native American. But on a positive note for you artists listening out there, on a positive note, they're starting to buy Native American jewelry from this country, and they want it to be real. They want it to be authentic. And so I'm hoping I see a time in the next 5 years that Native American jewelry will be welcome and loved like it is in the United States, but I would love to see it go to more of a world market. And with that, you get more competition for the product, and as a result, if there's more demand and the supply isn't as high, because there's only so much that can be made, then maybe the prices will even continue to go up and the artists will make more money. That's my hope.
All right. And if that's your hope, too, to see more Native jewelry or wearable artwork out there in the world, across the nation, call us. What do you think about this type of development when it comes to the changing supply and demand of making Native art? Call us right now. We want to hear from you. 1-800-996-2848 is the number to join us today. Also, we want to hear from you collectors, too. How has this affected what you buy, how often you buy, and maybe even whom you buy from? Call us right now. We want to hear from you. 1-800-996-2848 is the number, and we want to hear from you. You can also send us a tweet. We're on Twitter at 1-800-99-NATIVE. And I know there are many veteran Native jewelers out there. You've heard about supply and demand over your years or decades of making jewelry. Tell us a little bit about it. Do you think things are changing? Do you think there's a crisis when it comes to finding some of these precious items like turquoise, maybe even coral, or maybe even certain gems? Call us right now. We want to hear from you. 1-800-996-2848 is the number to join us. And you can also reach us on social media, on Facebook, as well as Twitter. And on Twitter, just look at 1-800-99-NATIVE. We're going to keep these phone lines open, and we will be right back. Because of the unique relationship Native American tribes have with the government, many crimes committed on Native land are often tried in federal court. Federal crimes have minimum sentencing requirements, and because of this, Native Americans often have longer sentences for their crimes. Join us as we talk about sentencing disparities in Native America on the next Native America Calling.
If he please, I'm standing at the crossroads, trying to flag it right. Lord, I'm standing at the crossroads, trying to
I'm Nathan. My job gave me a lot. It gave me an income to support my family. It gave me purpose and pride. But the secondhand smoke there triggered my severe asthma attacks, infections, and lung damage. And I never smoked. It was so bad that my doctor told me I shouldn't work there anymore. I had to quit my job. But the damage was done. Now I'm so sick, I can't do much of anything I used to love to do. I don't referee youth basketball anymore. I don't run or lift weights. It's too much for my body to take. Instead, I'm taking breathing treatments or oxygen. I guess you could say my job gave me a lot. So let me give you a tip. Don't let people tell you that working around secondhand smoke is safe.
Smoking affects more than just your health. If you or someone you know wants free help to quit smoking, call 1-800-QUIT-NOW. A message from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and CDC.
Welcome back. You're listening to Native America Calling. I'm Tara Gatewood from Isleta Pueblo. And we know that Native Americans have been using precious stones, gems, and also animal parts to make jewelry and other wearable items for many generations. And also, Alaska Natives carve and wear ivory. And in the Southwest, Natives love their turquoise and coral. And in recent years, people report that strict regulations and shortages of different materials have caused some Native artists, like jewelers, to change their craft and raise their prices. And today we are asking, are you filling the pool of rising prices or either a shortage of materials, especially when it comes to turquoise, coral, and even ivory? And is it changing your livelihood? Native artists, that question is for you. Call us right now. We want to hear from you. And our phone lines are open. The number is 1-800-996-2848. That's also 1-800-99-NATIVE. And on the line with us today, we have a sixth-generation Navajo silversmith, Jacob Morgan, on the line with us. He comes to us from Navajo Nation. And also, we have Gene Waddell, owner of Waddell Trading Company and co-owner of Lone Mountain Turquoise Mine. Our pleasure to welcome them back. And Gene, I wanted to ask you, you know, every time that you hear that there's a shortage of turquoise, what comes to mind? Are we freaking out, or is it valid to say that there's a shortage?
Well, I think that there is a shortage, and I think what causes that is that there's a need for natural. Many of the artists like Jacob and Veronica that are very high-end jewelers, and also the jewelers that Veronica mentioned and Jacob mentioned, Cody Sanderson, Lyndon Sosi, and I think Lee and Raymond Yazzie, who live in Gallup, New Mexico, their work is on display right now at the Smithsonian in Washington, D.C., Daryl Dean Begay, who's a very fine jeweler. They prefer the fine turquoise, like Veronica said, Bisbee turquoise. She mentioned different turquoise mines, Bisbee, I think Carrico Lake, Lone Mountain. But the thing to realize, the mines in Nevada, if you were to look at just the mines in Arizona and Nevada, and I'll give a quick explanation, I think it will help the artist, that some the older ones, the more wise ones, know this, the younger ones are learning, just like in my group, my family, my grandkids. But realize in Nevada, most of the turquoise is mined by mom-and-pop mines. They're not copper mines. They're not a byproduct where big equipment is mining it. So Nevada produces some of the finest in the world. I mean, Royston turquoise, Lone Mountain, Number 8, Blue Gem, all of those mines, Candelaria, are in Nevada. But if you were to say, all right, Gene, which ones are supplying turquoise, Candelaria is basically closed. The Audison family gets a little bit out, but it's just a little bit, and it can't supply a whole industry. Probably the most productive mine up there is Royston, and it produces beautiful green turquoise. In fact, if you were to say, where's most of the green turquoise produced in this country, it's produced in Nevada. When you get to Arizona, you have in the north Kingman. Well, Kingman is the largest producer right now in the country. If you artists are looking for a place to buy turquoise, a good place to start is Kingman. They have two types up there. One is stabilized and one is natural. And I know the family that owns it. Their name is Kolbaugh, and they're honest. If you say, I don't want stabilized, I want natural, they'll sell you the natural. It's more expensive.
And Gene, I'm going to put a pause right there. Tell us the difference between natural and stabilized.
Well, natural turquoise, it's natural as it comes out of Mother Earth. That's natural. You might clean it with water. You might, as the artists know, they're the ones who make it up, but you cut it on a grinding wheel. You fashion it into beautiful pieces, whether you cut it into a cabochon or you inlay it or you make it into beads. It's natural. It's totally natural out of Mother Earth. Much of the turquoise, probably as much as 80% that comes out of the earth, is chalk. It's low grade that has to be enhanced or stabilized in some way. Stabilization was invented in the 60s by a guy named Leonard Hardy. His group owned Kingman at that time. It was the late 60s. And they realized they were just wasting all this turquoise, so now they impregnate it with a plastic, with a polyresin plastic. And it's, some people call it stabilized, some call it plasticized. But the point is, the artists like you talked to this morning, they want natural. And that is getting harder to find. It's easier to find stabilized. If you go to Gallup right now, I mean, or Santa Fe, and you go to Scottsdale, most tourist shops that you go to are dealing with stabilized turquoise because it's more affordable. They're working with shops that work with jewelers. Most of it's real. Some of it, in my opinion, isn't made by native artists. But I think the true gallery or the true store who loves the art form, they want to work with artists that use natural turquoise. The difficult thing for the artist is finding it. And not only they can find it, like Jacob said, but if you find it, then you have to pay for it, and it's expensive. I mean, when we first opened Lone Mountain in the 70s, we sold the highest grade for $5 a carat. And I couldn't sell it. It was too high. Today, that same grade goes for 80 to 100 a carat. You know, medium grades go, a Bisbee, if it's a good grade, it'll go for 50 or 60. I've seen it go for 100. So to find turquoise at $10 a carat, there are dealers that go around and find good deals, and they supply the artists, and thank goodness for them.
And Gene, when you talk about carats, you know, what's the average amount that, you know, an artist, you know, is looking for to kind of, you know, make some items?
Well, maybe something that weighs, that's the size of a quarter. Let's use a quarter. Maybe that would weigh 20, depending on the thickness, but let's say that would weigh 20 carats. Well, 20 carats times 10 is $200. So if you put a quarter-sized stone on a ring and it costs you $200 plus your design and your labor and the silver, then you've got that much money in the piece. And I think that's what Jacob was saying. And then you have to take your markup, and if you sell it to a store, you wholesale it to them. So maybe you start out and you have $150 in it. But if you have a $200 stone plus the silver plus your time, then maybe it's going to cost you, you know, $300. And then all of a sudden it's a $900 ring. So if it gets too expensive, it does, I think, disrupt the flow of turquoise and native jewelry. But I do think there's enough around that's still being sold at you know, $4 to $8 a carat. Really great. Veronica mentioned Bisbee. Bisbee turquoise is closed now. They've completely closed it. And so the fellows that I know that are selling it for the higher grades are asking $40 to $60 a carat and beyond.
So, wow, that's a lot. And Bisbee is that one that's got that, you know, really alluring kind of like deep sea green to it. And Gene, you know, I think a lot is revealed when you break it down with these kind of prices and, you know, how we get to the price that you see if you're at a market or maybe even in a store. And hearing, you know, just kind of how it all breaks down, I want to hear your thoughts. Are you surprised to hear what you're hearing? Did it make, give you the backstory that you haven't heard as to why native jewelry is the price that it is. Call us right now. We want to hear from you. 1-800-996-2848. That's also 1-800-99-NATIVE. And Jacob, I want to hear your thoughts too on this of, you know, just hearing some of that breakdown. You know, has this changed the market any, maybe even fraud of people saying turquoise is turquoise when it really isn't? Is any of that coming into the picture?
It has. It has been for a while now. But if you're gonna, if you're an aspiring artist that you have every intention to be around for decades, to do this as a lifetime. You know, I'm a sixth generation silversmith, and so I eventually want to teach my girls and hand this tradition down. So it all depends on your approach. If you're in there just to be a cutthroat salesman, you know, get what you can while you can for the least amount of money, then yeah, there are people out there. Not just artists, but gallery owners. But for, if you are intent on making this a career, spend the extra money, buy good quality material. A good name, a good reputation is worth more than gold. And you get to a point, you're established. People don't have to second guess. They can trust you. With the technology that we have, we're able to you know, better interact with customers, with buyers. We still depend a lot on the gallery owners and the dealers. It's an ecosystem. You know, what's good for one is good for the other. We all help each other. But I would say for people that are looking to buy jewelry, if you're looking at one piece, there's 100 in a case, they all look alike, you might want to avoid that. You might want to start looking for gallery owners like Waddell Trading. You know, they specialize in high-end jewelry. They deal directly with the artist. Or you could deal with the artist directly yourself. And that way you know there's no hesitation. If they have a good reputation, solid name, you don't have to worry about much.
All right. Thanks for that, Jacob. And, you know, if you'd also like to chime in on this, please do call us at 1-800-996-2848. That's also 1-800-99-NATIVE. And we've heard a lot about the Southwest and, of course, turquoise. A lot of people think of turquoise when they think of native jewelry, but, you know, our native nations extend across the whole continent. I want to go ahead and hear another voice, too, and see what it's like in the upper Northwest. Joining us now from Seattle, Washington, is Andrew James, and he helps manage a longstanding family business called Mariskaya's of Nome in Alaska. And they work with artists from Northwest Alaska, including Inupiaq and St. Lawrence Island Yupik. And it's our pleasure to welcome Andrew to the hour. Hello, Andrew.
It's my pleasure to be here. Thank you so much. This has been just a real pleasure to listen to Jacob and Jane. It's been very dynamic listening to the two of you. A matter of fact, as you were finishing speaking there, Jacob, the first thing that I have to mention is the parallels and the similarities between the distance. Matter of fact, as you were talking about that, the symbiotic relationship and how important the connection is between galleries and sellers and artists, I was writing notes seriously about how important that is, and then I listening to you at the same time, and how that is a foundational part of how we need to move forward, and reminding people who maybe don't know how important that is and maybe don't understand that as much, to help impress upon them how important that is, something that we know. So I want to thank both of you first off, because that was really, really amazing and informative, and I'm just blown away listening to you talk.
Right on, James. Yes, we are learning a lot together today. And James, tell us about some of those parallels, or actually, Andrew, tell us about some of those parallels that you were feeling. You know, what is the translation? You know, what is the turquoise of your area?
Well, walrus ivory would be the primary. That would be the equivalent in our area amongst the coastal people we work with, which, as you said, would be the Inupiat or Eskimo, if you will, mainland groups. And then the St. Lawrence Island Yupik people of Savunga and Gamble are the two communities on St. Lawrence Island. A lot of parallels. I mean, there's definitely... Well, I could point out a lot of differences, but the shortages are an issue. It's a little different. A lot of it has to do with the hunt. A huge issue right now is with climate change and with how the way that warming temperatures are affecting the movement of ice and the ice flows and open water that they depend on for harvesting, amongst other large sea mammals, whales and seals, walrus in this case that we're speaking of. For food, of course, primarily, and then for tusk, which is so important. And I'll just kind of throw out quickly that they're protected under the Mammal Protection Act, under federal law, to be able to harvest those animals and to then use the ivory in order to make the art as they've been doing for thousands of years. So I get that out of the way really quick, for those, just to give a little background. So that is it's a big issue. It's been in the last few years, more and more hunters are just, having entire seasons where they're having, their harvest is virtually non-existent. Last year, I think it was, they had a federal state of emergency where they, food was the main issue. It's a whole nother conversation, really. But then we see it as buyers. Again, my family has had a business up there for 35 years, and we buy every day from these artists. So that's as far as just to speak to that shortage of material. That's the primary issue, and I'll leave that there.
Andrew, I'm also wondering, just hearing about that, and often it makes the headlines of, scandals going on with ivory or even black market. Can you tell us a little bit about that side of things? Has, the black market also compromised, artists just having, the availability of certain items or just even that reputation?
Can you black market as in, can you tell me what you mean specifically? Do you mean incidences
where people are selling ivory illegally?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, from our area,
just around the country, or in your area. Go ahead.
Sure. Yeah, I think. Well, first of all, qualify it by saying that there might be some isolated instances, and I think I think that. In principle, I think, first off, that people, in principle, should be very, very careful about being informed before making a judgment or speaking to a subject or an incident where they might not be informed enough to make a judgment. I think that there have been some issues that in the news that have been, of poaching, and it does happen on a very rare occasion, but it is without question, the exception rather than the rule. No question about it.
Andrew, something else that I'm wondering, with changing supply, sometimes shortages in material, Native Americans are known for, our ability to adapt and, come through and be innovative. How are some Native artists up in your area changing things? Are they reaching to other materials or how are they filling the void, if they fill a void?
I was listening intently to that part of this conversation about what turquoise and what's being done there, because I think there's a little bit of that happening. I think it's a little bit different in our area in that there hasn't been historically as much variety introduced as far as materials go. Both in as you guys are talking about the different types of turquoise and beyond turquoise, all these different stones. So they're, starting from that perspective, there wasn't as much. And the other thing is, just from my experience, and I'll qualify it by saying this is just my observations, having worked my whole life in this, the tusk and working in walrus ivory and the bone and the materials that are in the area around, like, say, St. Lawrence Island, for example, the artists work. It's such a part of, like, what they do and have always done. it wouldn't be so easy to just switch over to another material. With that said, though, I think it is really, really important to introduce some of that slowly and to try to do some of it, but to do it slowly and cautiously, because they could never really, like, just say, well, let's find a different material to work with because it's practical, because the walrus tusk is, you know, inextricably linked to not just, you know, how they make money and how, you know, they survive, but really who, you know, who they are as a people. And
all right.
I think, I'm sure, you know, Jacob could probably speak to that as somebody who's worked for generations with turquoise, that there has to be a balance there. It's more than just a material. It's more than just a means of making money. It's an important, you know, piece of culture, really. So,
and Andrew, you know, when we do talk about balance, and, you know, spreading more education of, you know, the struggles that Native artists face, when it comes to being able to afford, you know, some of the items that the people want, what about on the buyer side? Since we got you on the line and you have this perspective, what about buyers also understanding this and paying Native artists the prices they want? Is it always a fair trade, or are buyers keeping their prices what they were back in the days when things have inflated? Give us your take on that.
Sorry, we're breaking up a little bit. Can you repeat the last part of that, please?
Sure. Andrew, basically, you know, the prices are what they were in the past. The materials have gone up in price. Are buyers being sympathetic to this? Are they giving Native artists more money when it comes to wholesaling or buying their items? Or are they expecting those 1970 prices in 2015?
Right. So this is really interesting, and hearing again, hearing Jacob and Jean talk about this, it's not so black and white, because what happens in the market and what happens between buyers and artists, and I think we understand this amongst each other because we're working together every day, is the pressure is felt on both ends. So, for example, when sales are not good, when the market is depressed, when gas prices are going up, the artists are feeling that. And so is our small family business. We're all feeling that. And I have to be very careful not to go to an artist and say, and, you know, tell them my woes as the business. And I don't want to do that. But at the same time, I want to inform them about what is happening with our cash flow, with our day-to-day, because sometimes it is that tenuous with cash flow. Like, there's not a lot of money there. And I think this is where building trust in building relationships is so important, and this is why having trust and building, you know, relationships with families and with when building trust and in each other is important, because then you can have honest conversations about this, which is why as a dealer, like, it can, you know, people come in and this doesn't bother me, and I love to inform people about this. I love to talk about this, because this is a dynamic relationship, and it always is between, it's not easy to sell art and it's not easy to be an artist. And man, I know that as a dealer, and I think Gene could probably say the same, and Jacob knows that as well. And then we, you know, it's a dynamic thing. And this is, you know, I've had plenty of, I don't know if we say squabbles, but, you know, where you're talking to an artist and you try to get to a point where you're both can live with it. You know, I'm worried about, we're worried about cash flow and there, but they, you know, they need to get enough too. And you try to find a balance, you know?
Sure. Let's go ahead and hear Gene's take on that too. Gene, you know, share your thoughts on this about buyers also, you know, moving their prices, you know, or paying Native artists more because there is inflation or shortage of supply. Gene, go ahead.
Well, our philosophy has always been in Waddell Trading, and I again grew up in this business, was that pay artists a fair price. And most artists tell me their price, and I pay the price. Occasionally we'll debate it. We never argue it. Because I always say that true artists, like like Jacob and some of the people we've talked about today, I said, you guys have options to deal with whoever you want. So I just want the best quality that we can have to sell to our customers. And some are casual customers that might be secretaries or might work down the street, and they're dependent, their income, they only have so much expendable income. And then you have people who can afford anything. But I think we have to realize not everybody can. And the big markets to sell this, or for at least in the Southwest, is at the Herd Museum show, and then people live from the Herd many times to Santa Fe Indian Market. I think we need to expand the market more, and I think the Smithsonian's done that. They have a couple of shows a year. I know that many of the people we discussed today have done shows in Japan several times. Cody Sanderson has become famous there. I mean, he's a celebrity in Japan right now, which is fabulous. He's a great friend. He's done a good job. So I think we have to open up and realize that the potential, and as you said, with Native American people in general, they're very adaptable, and they've been adaptable in very tough times. And I think we're in good times. I think that I think Native American goods in general, and specifically I deal in jewelry, is a bargain.
All right. And Gene, I'm going to put a hold on that because we got to get ready to get out of the hour, and I don't want to close it without Jacob chiming in on this. Jacob, anything you'd like to add about being on the other side of the counter? Are dealers willing to work with you and raise, you know, what they're giving to you? Go ahead, Jacob.
Well, one thing you have is a business. And because of that, no matter how sacred, no matter how important these things are to us, the general public classifies us as luxury items. So when dealing with galleries, dealing with customers, you have to realize that there is a market, a preset market. My bracelet can't sell for as much as Sunshine Reeves. It's just a fact. He's established. He's won many awards. So you have to keep in mind where you line in that market. And if you're spending a lot of money on pieces, you have to be willing to throttle back your profits. It's just a fact of life. So that's what I encourage people to do.
All right. Thank you very much, Jacob Morgan, for joining us today. Also, Gene Waddell and Andrew James. And if there's still more left to say, please do send us an email. Our address is comments@nativeamericacalling.com. You can also comment directly on our website. That's going to wrap it up for today's show. Thanks to our crew, Monica Brain, Andy Murphy, and Stephen Emmons. Also, Kavi Movahead screened your calls today. And thanks to Antonia Gonzalez, anchor and producer of National Native News. I'm your host, Tara Gatewood. We'll be back tomorrow.
The Convention and Tourism Department of the Albuquerque Hispano Chamber of Commerce provides convention and event planning services for Native American organizations. Information at ahcnm.org. Supported by the National Indian Education Association, an inclusive Native organization representing Native students, educators, families, communities, and tribes. Membership registration available at niea.org.
This program supported by the Peace Corps, the government agency sending thousands of volunteers to live and work alongside people in more than 60 countries worldwide. The Peace Corps will allow you to share your unique cultural heritage and promote world peace and friendship. We have rewarding work opportunities around the world in education, health, agriculture, environment, and business. It will change your life and the lives of others. More information available at peacecorps.gov. That's peacecorps.gov.
Native America Calling is produced in the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation, a Native nonprofit media organization located in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, the McCune Charitable Foundation, and the Ford Foundation. Music is provided by Brent Michael Davids. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.